Hey there, and welcome to the podcast. My name is Becky. I'm dressed like I dressed in high school. And sitting across from me is Cedric Stout, who's dressed in all white, looking angelic. And you're listening to the Happy Project Podcast. Listen.
What am I hearing? Listening to what?
You know. You're listening to...
Yeah. Oh, it is.
The Happy Project.
The Happy Project Podcast.
Yeah.
Hey, Cooks.
Hey.
You look very good today.
Thanks. I'm literally wearing shorts and an undershirt, but...
You look good.
I'll take the compliment.
Yeah.
You look rather young and fresh.
Okay, that was creepy. Yeah, no. No, I do look young. I admit it. Yeah. I'm wearing these cargo pants.
It's because
pants.
Of her outfit.
Yeah.
That's why. Just to clarify.
So my face isn't
young. No, and her face looks very young, as always.
Oh.
Goes without saying.
Uh-huh.
So as I dig myself out of the hole, hey, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
When you think of, I guess, movies, right? I guess TV shows could fall into this, but what is the most creative movie? What is the most creative movie you can think of that you've seen?
What?
And creative in a sense of maybe how it was shot or maybe the concept, anything.
Oh.
What's the most creative?
This is a hard question.
Mm.
Because you have things that are written very interestingly,
mm-hmm.
right? And then you have ones that are produced very interestingly.
Right.
And then you have things that are just interesting.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Creative.
Oh, creative.
Creative.
Wow. I am thinking about, I think, so I've mentioned this to you before and nobody agrees with me, but I think The Fall is a very creative movie. This is not a very well-known film, but I think that one's very creative. I also think some of the old school things where they had real live stunts happening,
mm-hmm.
like, Buster Keaton's
movies?
Yeah. I think his are very like creative. Like the way the stunts are created.
Yeah. Especially
really
100
creative.
Years ago. For 100 years
Can
ago.
Can you believe
like
it's been 100
amazing.
Years? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess things like that are very creative. Right?
Okay.
I kind of like
so there's not like
things.
One movie that comes to mind? Like,
no.
Like,
are you trying to…
Was,
are you pointing at something?
No,
trying
no. To think of something? I mean, I have something. And there's a reason why I'm bringing it up.
Okay.
But
what's what for you?
Okay, so literally today I started a movie during my workout, and the movie is on Netflix.
Okay,
and it's called Missing.
Oh,
did
I
you,
see where
you,
you're
yeah,
going.
Yeah, yeah. So
okay.
So here's the thing: like I started it today, and this is in no relation to the fact that we are recording this podcast today because it actually will relate.
Yeah.
But I decided because like when I do my cardio, I usually do my weights. It takes about like an hour or so. And then I'll do cardio at the end. And the last couple of weeks or even months, I've pretty much just chosen a show or a movie to watch just to kind of make my cardio go by a little bit quicker.
Yeah.
And so today I started Missing, which is
missing.
A movie that came out today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the concept is probably the most creative that I've seen or experienced in a long time. And I'm not going to give anything away, of course. So
oh,
no spoilers
okay.
here.
And wait, but is this like they filmed it over Zoom and stuff?
It's essentially,
like
yeah. So it's from the perspective of like from the computer and from like this girl, her name is June. She's the main character from like her desktop.
Oh.
And so it's like a lot of the shots are literally showing her as if you're watching her as if you're looking at her from your computer.
Weird.
Or from her desktop rather.
Okay.
And so you'll see like her FaceTime app open and this is how she is communicating with the people around her.
Mm.
And that's not the whole entire movie, but I think that is sort of the baseline of the cinematography in the movie. So it's so creative. And I think I'm, let's see, I did 30 minutes of cardio. So I'm 30 minutes into the movie and it's just like, wow, like, whoever put it together and the editing is brilliant because it kept my attention the whole time. But I just saw that's so unique. And I don't think anyone has done it, at least on the scale like this.
Mm-mm.
So yeah, I find that to be very interesting. And obviously, as the title of the movie says, someone goes missing. And I guess that has a lot to do with what we're going to actually talk about today. And so I think the timing is like, perfect.
Yeah. Well, that is a great opening question that you bring up because, yes, it is kind of related to what we're going to discuss today, which is what happens if your Korean partner decides to kidnap your child and take them to Korea?
Dee-doo-dee. Oh, sorry. And then you do the
transition.
Oh, my bad.
Why did you come in with that?
Oh, you can cut that out.
Yeah, I'm going to. Oh. Okay, here we go. So today we are going to talk about a few cases of when a Korean partner had taken their child away from wherever country they were previously and kidnapped their own kid to Korea. And what happened there was this child reunited with the other parent from whom the child had gone missing. Wow, this is getting convoluted. But what Korea did in these instances and what is happening right now, actually, with a current case that is unfolding before our eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like thinking about the idea of like one parent taking a child without the other parent's consent and maybe going internationally to another country. Like it's kind of weird to think of that as abduction, right? Because it's like your child. But, you know, when both parents have, let's just say, equal custody, obviously, you know, one parent, if they find their child is gone without against their will, then yeah, that would be classified as abduction.
It's really weird because
is it kidnap? I guess abduction and kidnapping would be considered two different things.
But the thing is, it gets a little bit complicated because now, if we're talking about in domestic cases, the parents are both married. There is no defined custody. So both parents, technically, you legally have equal custody of the child.
Right.
So if one parent decides to take the child and run off somewhere into the US, let's say, legally, this is not kidnapping because they have custody of the child. Of course, this is a domestic issue that needs to be resolved and it can get a little complicated. But if you then are divorced and the parent who does not have custody of the child takes the child without the other parent's consent, that would be considered a kidnapping. And it gets even more confusing when you're crossing international lines because each country handles these cases differently. Not only is within a domestic, how does a country handle domestic issues? And as we'll talk about, Korea handles domestic issues a little bit differently than the US. Or it also becomes, it's like the country's choice about the domestic issue between the legal lines of abduction, kidnapping. Is this a crime? Is this not? And you're kind of at the mercy of the country where you're trying to get your child from.
Right. Yeah. So like these cases that we're going to talk about today, I mean, there's one that, actually two of them that we're going to talk about are ongoing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I heard about this maybe a couple of, I want to say while we were in Korea.
Yeah.
So it was definitely over a year ago. But I think it also came back up into the public's sphere more recently within the last year.
Yeah.
Because of the reasons we're going to discuss.
Right.
So, I think I first heard about it probably a year and a half, 2 years ago. This first case that we're going to talk about.
Yes.
So, I mean, why did you actually come up with this podcast topic to talk about?
Yeah, well, you're right, because it was a couple years ago and I remember exactly what year, 21, 22, but I was reading the Korea Times and I saw the photo of this man. He was running on a treadmill with a picture, cardboard cutouts of children, two children.
Yeah.
And he had a sign that said, 아이들이 너무 보고 싶습니다. And what caught my eye was, yes, it was odd, but he was in front of 동대문, like DDP.
Right,
where Seoul Fashion Week happens. And I am accustomed to seeing DDP as the background for Fashion Week, Seoul Lights, Fashionistas, all of that. And then to see this man, this white man running on a treadmill in front of there, I was like, what? That is so bizarre. So that's the thing. The photo caught my eye. I distinctly remember that moment. And then reading the article, I kind of led into a rabbit hole of like, is this actually happening right now? The title of that article is called American Father's Battle to Find Missing Children in Korea. And the man that we're speaking about who appeared in this photo, his name is John Sichi, was the pronunciation?
Yeah, I believe so, Sichi.
And he's a white man from San Francisco, a software engineer. and his son and daughter went missing in Korea, involving an international abduction by his Korean wife.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, his Korean wife and him, I believe they were married in California, mm-hmm. and they were pretty much settled in California, and that and they ended up having their children in 2017 and 2018 while still married.
Yeah.
But apparently at this time, they started to have a little bit of marital conflicts and some issues mm-hmm. in the marriage, like pretty much any couple, any normal couple does. And there doesn't seem to be or any evidence of any physical mm-hmm. or any sort of abuse involved. Yep. It's just marital issues probably arising because of
cultural differences.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so this is pretty much the background of this whole situation.
Yeah. And it looks like, so if you read the article, and there's a number of articles out now where you can kind of follow along with this story. But John had said that the wife decided, this was in 2019, she decided, you know what, I'm going to go to Korea with the kids. We just need to cool off, take mm-hmm. our own separate time. And she went to Korea, but she never came back.
Right.
So in 2019 of December, and then January 2020, John went to Korea to try to persuade her, okay, why don't you come back to the U.S. with the kids? And apparently she had agreed, but then canceled the plane tickets in February, withheld the children's passports. The kids are dual citizens, so mm-hmm. they can live in both Korea and the U.S., and just never came back.
Right, yeah. Right. And so John is left obviously wondering, why isn't his kids coming back? Mm-hmm. Why isn't his wife coming back? Mm-hmm. And so he ended up going to the San Francisco County Superior Court. Mm-hmm. And this process took months.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the wife from Korea apparently participated in this whole process over the phone. Mm-hmm. And in August 2020, the court finally ordered that the children had to come back to the U.S.
So it's important to remember that this is a San Francisco U.S. court.
Right.
That is demanding the wife and the children who are in Korea, you must come back to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not really any teeth here. They can say that. They can say, no, John Si-chi has the legal and physical custody of the children.
Yep.
They can say that. But she doesn't have to comply. And she could just stay in Korea. And that is apparently what she did. So it was in November 2020 when John went to Korea and filed a request with the Seoul Family Court. Now he's going to the Korean side of things to request the return of his children under the Hague Convention on the Civil Aspects of International Child Abduction. And he accused his wife of international parental child abduction. So I'm thinking up at this point, it looks like in 2020, when he got the custody of the kids, I'm mm-hmm. guessing a divorce was finalized. At this point?
Yeah, I guess I would assume so. I don't remember reading about that.
Right, right.
But yeah, I don't know how divorce works in California in terms of… I think it is a little tricky in California from what I understand. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so…
Either way, he has custody of the kids.
Right, right. So I assume they're not… Yeah. Well, they're physically not together, obviously.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
On paper, I'm not completely sure.
Right.
But yeah, and so this act that you mentioned, mm-hmm. the Hague Convention on the Civil Aspects of International Child Abduction,
yes,
or also known in shorter form, HCCAICA.
Oh yeah, that's much easier to remember.
Right, right. So it's very long, but this is also referred to as the Hague Abduction Convention for short. So so we'll probably use the shorter form.
Okay, you're right.
On that. So just know that this is what we're talking
convention,
about.
But what is this? Like, I think it's important for people to know what is the Hague Convention. So you can kind of have an idea of like within what context this is kind of happening. But the Hague Convention, this is kind of, it's an international treaty. All right. So it's not actually a hardcore law that mm-hmm. is all over the countries, but it's an international treaty that was brought up in 1980 and it's signed by 93 countries, I believe, at the moment. And this international treaty is designed or was designed to protect children from international parental abductions, just like this.
Right.
To set the standard. Okay, this is allowed, this is not. And interestingly enough, it also set the standards for inter-country adoptions. So anybody who was adopted after the 80s. I think, however, that adoption happened should have been handled under the Hague Convention.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't looked fully into that, but it's definitely an interesting side note. And in 2012, it seems Korea also joined the treaty.
Right, right. I think in 2009, this is when they pretty much started mm-hmm. to consider, I guess, being part of this because there was a rise in international marriages
yeah.
and relationships. And so finally… or officially in 2012. That's when Korea ratified the treaty. Mm-hmm. So they agreed formally to be a part of this.
Yeah.
And so just for reference, because this helps me to understand, I guess, what the Hague Convention or the Abduction Convention includes. It's essentially just a framework for all of these countries who have formally agreed to be a part of this. Mm-hmm. It's just a framework on how to deal with each other and how to work with each other. When it, you know, whether it comes to international adoptions or in cases of abduction.
Yeah.
And so it's really just like a partnership in many ways of like, okay, if something happens, you know, between these countries, there's a system in place and how to deal with each country.
Even less than a system, it's just like an agreement.
Yeah.
This is how we're going to handle it. Okay. So now internally, your country needs to set up your authority. Whatever form of government is going to deal with this.
Exactly.
We have our form of government that deals with it like this. We should at least be on the same page.
Right. And every country who is part of this treaty, they need to have a central authority in their country so that there's a one-stop shop.
Yes.
And this will come up a little later and it's very important, but there's one place or central figure in each country that will be able to deal with anything under this act.
Yes. That's a great summary. Okay. Mm-hmm. Very excellent. And in Korea, like we had mentioned before, we have Seoul Family Court. And this is a branch of government in Korea. I think it's under the Ministry of Justice. Either way, there are multiple family courts around the country. So Seoul Family Court was the one that John Si-chi had initially appealed to. And it seems in 2021, he was able to finally visit the children. And I don't know if that was due to Seoul Family Court stepping in or anything. Mm-hmm. I think it was just personally between him and his wife. And then 6 months after his initial complaint, Seoul Family Court then ordered, okay, you must return the children according to the Hague Convention. So they stepped in finally and said, yes, under the Hague Convention, the wife must return the children to John Si-chi, who has legal custody of them.
Right. And I believe at this point, if I understand correctly, I think this is probably the last time he actually physically saw his children.
Oh.
And I don't think he was able to actually like touch them, but they were in the same room.
Oh, wow.
And I remember watching a video where he said he essentially just waved and kissed his daughter. She, you know, did the motion back to him. And I think that was the last time he physically actually saw them. So it was under that context.
Yeah. And it's important to know the children are quite young. I mm-hmm. think right now, maybe they're 4 or 6, 3 or 5. Again, I'm not entirely sure with like the 국제나이 or 한국나이, like how the ages were described. But either way, they're quite young. So,
right.
You know, this is important. And when he went to visit the children, it's reported there were no child psychologists present, no child protective services present. It seems to be it was John Si-chi and then maybe a police officer, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So it seems like, and this is in May 2022, where they went to the apartment and essentially…
It was a high tension situation.
Yeah, and he was not allowed to speak to the children.
Yeah.
The wife was hysterical, apparently, just yelling. And obviously, the children are going to be afraid.
Of course.
You know, in that context, they don't know what's happening.
Yeah.
And they've been with mom this whole time.
Yeah.
So obviously, they're going to trust mom and want to be in her care.
Yeah.
And so what doesn't make sense is essentially the officials, they only went up to the point of going to the apartment after they located her, mm-hmm. but they didn't actually enforce the children, going with dad.
Right. Yeah. And there's a reason for that. I can't recall exactly where I found it. There was a Korean lawyer who had brought this up. But basically in Korea, if let's say you owe somebody some debt, mm-hmm. the debtor can have a police officer go to your house and take that item. Or take whatever it is in order to pay off your debt. They can physically do that. But in this case, the police have no right. They cannot do that lawfully and take the children to the person who legally, quote unquote, owns them.
Right.
So the most that they could do is ask the children, do you want to go with dad? And if they say no, then they could not physically remove the children from the premises.
Right. And that makes a lot of sense.
I mean,
right?
It does make a lot of sense. Yes, because I mean, it is children. It's not property.
Yeah.
But it's very sad to think about this, right? There's literally nobody enforcing this legal court order.
Yeah. I mean, I was being sarcastic with that. I see what you were saying. Okay. No. But I'm saying like, oh, it's a great idea to ask the 3 and 5 year old, do you want to go with dad
in the midst of
your mom yelling and like being hysterical?
Yeah.
And
you
know,
what are you gonna say?
And I don't even know if John was able to, maybe he was outside the apartment. I'm not sure if he was actually physically in view of the children, but like, of course, what, you know, the kids are gonna.
And also, like, John doesn't speak Korean at that time, especially he didn't speak Korean. The children now, I think they only speak Korean because mom speaks Korean.
Of course.
And they're living there.
And they're in Korea.
So yeah, you have all of these barriers in the way.
Yeah.
So finally, so in 2022, November, John Si-ji, he files a police report for missing children. And this is different from a criminal report of abduction.
Right. And that is because the wife, after that incident, bounced.
Just vanished.
Vanished. Didn't know, you know, he couldn't contact her. He didn't know where they were. Yeah. No address on file.
Yeah. So, Go ahead.
And so that's why he ended up filing that report.
I think it was about that time. Maybe it was October. Yeah, October of 2020, where then he started doing this protest. Mm-hmm. Because if legally he couldn't get the support, then publicly he needed to get the support. He needed to get the story out to the media so that they could help him. And up to this point, that has pretty much been the only help he has gotten. Mm-hmm. So he started this protest on a treadmill. And that's where I first saw that photo.
Yeah.
And he walks on this treadmill and you can see him all around Seoul. Like if you're in the city, you might have actually seen him at some point. He's still doing it to today. And he walks on this treadmill and it symbolizes his endless walking, his endless fight that goes nowhere, trying to get his children. He says, I would walk to the ends of the earth for my children. He's physically showing that, symbolizing his ongoing struggle with the Korea's legal system. And then that's where he has the cardboard cutouts of his 2 children and the sign, 아이들이 너무 보고 싶습니다. I really miss my children. I really want to see my children. And so by doing this, he's getting more media attention. And it looks like that's what happened in November of 2022. 궁금한 why, a local broadcasting station made a story on his protest. And that's after that. The U.S. State Department and South Korean Ministry of Justice, then they were able to find the new address of the wife and kids.
Right.
Yet still nothing further has been done. Mm-hmm. And the wife is being fined. Looks about 500,000 Korean won a day. That would be what?
Like, about $400-ish.
$400 a day.
As of today.
Yeah. So they're doing a fine. And she also is forcing detention. Like she goes to a detention center, I guess, for a couple of days. I'm not sure how exactly it works out for the amount of time that she's keeping the children. That is the severity of punishment.
Yeah.
So if somebody is willing to just keep paying that money, I don't care. Go to the detention center, I don't care. Still, they cannot be forced to give up the children.
Yeah, I don't even know if she's paying the money. I mean, she's being fined,
right?
It's being racked up. But like, if it's almost like empty threats, it seems like.
Yeah.
Like, you know, from the perspective of like the courts, like to her, she's just like, whatever, I'm just going to pretend like it doesn't exist.
Isn't that crazy?
I mean, $400 a day and you're just like keeping. No, I think she's probably just…
maybe she's just not paying
ignoring
it.
Yeah, and just letting it rack up. And, you know… Who knows how long this will go?
Yes. And so John Si-ji's story and his protest has been catching international attention. And I think this is very, very important because Korea, if you look through the history, there have been numerous cases where the government has committed terrible crimes. And I'm not saying they're committing this crime, but maybe allowing this crime to happen. But they have done this in the past, like the uprising, Gwangju uprising is a great example, right? Or the Jeju uprising. These cases where terrible crimes have been committed by the government and nothing was changed until international attention was given.
Right.
So John is among, I think, 6 American parents right now whose Korean spouse has taken their child to Korea and refused to return them. This is between 2020 and 2021, according to the U.S. State Department annual report on international parental abduction. And right now, there is no legal consequence, legal teeth. Korea's government is not moving any further to help John Si-ji's case. So why don't we just take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and talk about another ongoing case of international parental child abduction in Korea. Okay, so now we are back.
That was a long wait.
It's funny when we're recording this, but yes, now we're back. Why don't we talk about the next case that is ongoing right now?
Yeah, so there is another person by the name of Jay Song, who is a Korean American, mm-hmm. and he's from Washington State. And he's in somewhat of a similar situation as John Cici. In fact, they actually know each other and they've gotten to know each other through this situation. In 2019, his six-year-old son was kidnapped by his ex-wife to Korea. And so they actually had a divorce before this happened. Mm. And his wife was supposed to just go on a three-week vacation with their three-year-old son at the time.
Yeah.
And they just never came back.
Right.
So this is also key because the son was three and this is 4 years in the making. Mm-hmm. So the son is six or seven at the time or
now,
right now at the time of this recording. And so this one is also another heartbreaking story because, you know, I actually found Jay Song's YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. He has a YouTube channel where, you know, he'll post things about the abduction that maybe got media attention, but he also posts his own videos. And it's sort of like a couple of minutes, kind of like a video diary, messages to his son.
It's just like, you know. That's heartbreaking.
He'll speak in mostly in Korean to his son and then occasionally in English. For me, I needed to go and like seek out from Jay Sung's perspective, like how is he really feeling, mm-hmm. you know, to get a greater sense of empathy and just seeing him in that way really humanizes him because we hear about abductions all the time, mm-hmm. right? And it's easy to just, you know, feel bad, but I mean, like think about how it really feels to be in their shoes. And so like watching his videos just kind of puts me in that place of, wow, this is real.
Yeah.
And this is a daily thing this man has to deal with.
Yeah. And it seems the ex-wife is doing the same thing as John Cici's mm-hmm. ex-wife. She's just letting the legal fees rack up and the days of detention, but she's not complying to the court orders. And it doesn't look like Jay Sung can do too much either. He has legal custody of his son
right.
in the U.S.,
right.
But now they're in Korea and it's like you have to apply to whatever Korea's legal system is doing when they handle issues like this under the Hague Convention.
Right.
So I think to explain a little bit, Seoul Family Court, they are part of the Ministry of Justice. They're the government branch. They have, like you mentioned before, they have the exclusive jurisdiction over these cases, international abduction cases. They also handle domestic relations, juvenile offense cases. This includes domestic violence and child abuse, which we know Korea doesn't have a sterling reputation of handling.
Right.
Okay, we do know that. We're not going to get into like domestic abuse cases here. But in Korea, it's a little bit like, you know, oh, it doesn't involve me. It's between you guys and you guys handle it kind of situation. So the police has not always been very helpful when it comes to, oh, this is an issue between husband and wife. Okay, you guys handle it.
Right.
But John Cici makes a great point of saying this is not an issue of husband and wife. This is an issue of man versus Korea legal system.
Right.
Trying to get his children. So that's, you know, that's that. So yeah, there's not really any legal teeth in Korea. I know I keep saying that phrase, but it just seems to be correct. You're right. It does seem a little bit of just like show. You mm-hmm. know, it's performative. Oh, here's some fees, but nothing really happens.
Right, exactly. And it's sort of a passive approach, you know, to from the, I guess, the legal system or the government's, you know, side in Korea.
Yeah.
That's what it seems like.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so like from the perspective of the U.S. and, you know, disclaimer, we should have threw it out in the beginning. We're not immigration or like lawyers or anything like that. So
I don't think anybody thought that.
Okay,
ever.
Good. So we're trying our best to interpret everything.
Yeah.
But so in the U.S., so when parents are married, they obviously have equal custodial rights until the family court issues custody arrangements for whatever reason, right? And if there are no court orders, it is not custodial interference for a parent to keep the child from the other.
Right.
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 So that is just, I guess, a little bit of fun legal fact.
Right. Very fun, guys.
Very fun there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there is, I guess, again, from the U.S. perspective, there is an act that was enacted, the International Parental Kidnapping Crime Act, which means it's a federal crime for a parent to take the child out of the country with the intent of interfering with the other parent's custodial rights. So in the case of Jay Songs, that's exactly what the ex-wife did.
Exactly.
Right.
But yeah, like things are a little bit different when you have this crisscross of international barriers. U.S. can say this, la 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 la. But if Korea does not want to comply, and it looks like it's not even a matter of they don't want to. It's almost like they don't care to, which is really weird. So, I mean, Korea is technically part of the Hague Convention. Mm-hmm. Technically, they have signed this treaty. Yet the Korean Ministry of Justice is not carrying it out.
Right. I mean, they are on paper.
Yeah.
Right? The courts gave John Se-chi like, hey, yep, the kids need to be returned to you.
Yeah.
But, you know, like we mentioned, their officials go to the house and they're like, okay, little three-year-old, do you want to stay here or go back to the United States, this big old unknown country to you now?
Yeah.
Because you don't remember how it was when you were born.
Exactly. And it seems like John Se-chi's case, Jay Song's case, have brought this more into light. And in 2021, the U.S. State Department listed Korea as non-compliant with the Hague Convention.
Right.
Some other countries included would be like Brazil, Ecuador, Honduras, Romania. But yeah, so the State Department has officially said, okay, Korea, you're not compliant with the Hague Convention. You can say all you want, but you're not. So Korea's Ministry of Justice, Ministry of Health, Welfare, and Family Affairs. Let me skip that part. You already say all this. Mm-hmm. Skip. Hold on.
Sure.
Okay. Something that is also important to note. Yes, Korea is also not quite compliant with the Hague Convention. But what about in the cases, you know, where you have a Korean parent and then a parent from another country? This is a lot of cases with migrant brides who are from countries like China or Vietnam, the Philippines or Cambodia, who have also not signed the Hague Convention Agreement. There are situations where those, typically wives, have taken their mixed children back to their home country and the Korean parent is not able to go and get them because the countries there are also not under the Hague Convention. So it's weird that like you have this double standard.
Yeah.
It's also happening to some Korean husbands, their children being kidnapped to other countries and not able to fight the legal system there. Yet in Korea, when let's say this American parent is trying to get their child back, Korea is not applying to that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like, it's crazy that this is happening and Korea doesn't do anything. Especially now as the rise of international marriages happening in Korea, it's more and more important that these things are discussed not on a fun, trendy way of cross-cultural love like we see on the internet, but literal legal standards to protect families and to protect children who are born from these interracial marriages to be protected within Korea.
Right.
Yeah.
So when it comes to Korea not being compliant with the Hague Abduction Convention and trying to figure out why, I mean, there's a couple of things that might contribute to it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know for sure, of course, but you know, Korea's Ministry of Justice does not actually have the staff to deal with only international child abductions.
Yeah.
Right. So their staff, I mean, even though that is their jurisdiction, so to speak, I mean, they deal with other, you know, many other things. And so something that needs a lot of attention and focus, like child abductions, is going, I don't want to say ignored, but I mean, they don't have the manpower to really focus on it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And as far as, I guess, ramifications for the non-complying parent who is in violation, there's at this point, as we already have seen, there's only like fines and detention.
Yeah.
And I don't even know what detention means.
Right. I don't know either.
Yeah. But it's to me, it's just like a slap on the wrist for something so huge as abducting a child over international waters.
Yeah. It's like Korea also, there's a lot of Korea first mindset. And this is almost kind of reflective of that a little bit. Where instead of, oh, you are a father who loves your child, it's more like, oh, you are a foreigner in this country.
Yeah.
So in a way, I don't know if it's explicit, but it feels like that when I see these kind of cases where it's like, instead of taking the side equally of parents who love their children, it's just kind of like, oh, well, you're not Korean. This is Korea.
Right.
You know, don't get in the way. But yeah, they don't have the manpower. They're just doing these fines. And so in John's case, like the police are not getting more involved.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he has yet filed a criminal complaint against the mother on charges of child abduction within Korea, in which case the police would be able to get more, intensive in getting these children back. But at the moment, they cannot take the children by force.
Right.
And so this is why John and maybe Jay Song and maybe some other parents are going more through indirect enforcement, which is, like we said, putting pressure on Korea government as a whole, highlighting this through the media and getting the word out. So the Ministry of Justice has found where the children are, mm-hmm. which is dealing with John's case of yeah. missing children. But in the case of like a compulsory, what's the word? Like, what's the word?
A rescue mission.
A rescue mission, yeah. Taking the children. Yeah. They can't do that. So that's why John is doing this protest,
right.
which is very unique and also very heartbreaking.
Right. And let me throw in there something that I don't even know if you know, but you know, I actually heard John Cicci mention, the question came up of, you know, you're here in Korea, you've been in Korea for months and months and, you know, going on years now, mm-hmm. and you're staying in Airbnbs and things like that. It's mm-hmm. got to take a toll on you financially. Mm-hmm. You know, and his response, and I'm paraphrasing, is, you know, I've been very fortunate to have, you know, a really good engineering job, AKA, you know, I make a lot of money, mm-hmm. but he has, it's taken a toll on him and on his wallet because he has spent, and this was, I think, by March of this year. So this is as of a couple of months ago, mm-hmm. he spent almost $1 million trying to, you know, with the legal fees. You know, staying in Korea, mm-hmm. I'm sure, you know, because he doesn't have the visa, he's probably going in and out of the country.
Yeah, yeah.
Because U.S. citizens can only stay 90 days at a time with yeah. their passports. So yeah, it's, man, $1 million.
I can't even imagine.
You know, I mean, and this guy is just, he's not losing hope.
Yeah.
And it's just so, it's heartbreaking, but it's also very, I don't know what the word is. Encouraging isn't the right word, but it's like, it's like I look up to that and I respect that so much because
yeah.
it's a father who is fighting to the death, essentially, you know, the financial death.
Yeah,
at least.
It's a little bit different than like other cases, maybe where a child goes missing and parents will search for years and years in the hopes of finding. And a lot of times you keep searching because you just want to know what happened
sure,
at the end. If the
right.
child was killed or, you know, whatever, there's no way you can get them back. In some way, at least you get some resolution.
Mm-hmm.
As awful as it may sound. But in this case, it's like, you know they're there and you cannot reach them.
Yeah.
Which I think why his protest that is so symbolic of that is very poignant to people.
Mm-hmm.
So he is trying to get enough media attention to put pressure on the government to make some changes. There is a petition that you can sign and he's seeking signatures right now. And it's basically asking Korean officials to strengthen enforcement measures, legislate harsher penalties. How can we change? Korea needs to look bad internationally. And it sounds awful, but maybe that's the way that the pressure needs to go. So we will right. put this petition up on the website and you can sign it. You can take a look at all of that and sign to help support that. Okay, so we have mentioned these two ongoing cases, which are definitely tragic.
Yeah.
And we're watching it unfold before our eyes. I hope that you will keep up with it. And I think now we'll mention a final case of one that did get resolved. And this is a very interesting one. I don't know if you want to… It is uplifting in a way.
In a sense,
it is
yeah.
admirable to the lengths of which a mother will go for her children. And we'll just leave it at that. So why don't we talk about the case of Tiffany Rubin? So now we're going to talk about a final case. One that has at least, if not necessarily a happy ending… Because I don't think in the case of… parental abductions, you can really have a happy ending.
Right.
But this is more of a conclusive ending. This is the case of Tiffany Rubin. And she was a mother from Queens. I believe she's still living in Queens. According to an article that I found, I think it came out like last year. Because this is kind of like one of those true crime stories that people like to keep bringing back up to the surface,
mm-hmm.
you know, over and over again. But Tiffany Rubin, so in 2007, her son Kobe was abducted by his Korean father. Who goes by multiple names, Jeffrey Lee, Lee Kang-sik, and one that I found interesting, Jeffrey Salko.
Salko.
Because when I heard it, I was like, that sounds suspiciously like Psycho. Maybe that was his real nickname.
Yeah.
He was like, hi, I'm Jeffrey Salko. And she's like, Psycho? Salko? He said, yeah, Salko.
That's interesting. That
weird
I guess
name.
He obviously, well, he did choose the name, I'm assuming, since he's Korean.
Unless everyone was calling, hey, it's Jeffrey Psycho. And then, you know, it just stuck to him. Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, we'll find out why he was a little psycho.
Yeah. But so, Lee Kang-sik, Jeffrey Salko was from Korea, Tiffany from Queens. And eventually they divorced. Kobe went to his dad's place for a custodial visit. And Salko, who was facing prison for delinquent child support, took Kobe and fled to South Korea.
Right. So I believe that it was under the pretense of they were going to take a 3-week vacation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that was, so the mother, so Tiffany, was under that impression.
I see. Mm-hmm. I see. So it wasn't just like up and gone.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Like visiting on the weekend and they're gone.
Right.
Yeah. I don't think that's the case.
Okay. Well, at this point, when he went off to South Korea, I think the timing was pretty good in terms of the FBI's involvement because they were going to release a federal arrest warrant for later for him, apparently that year. It doesn't seem like Jeffrey Salko was a nice person. But
yeah.
That arrest warrant now getting help from the FBI, which I think plays a part later on. Because in the case of like John Si-chi or Jae Song, you didn't have this kind of criminal probe involvement here. But in this case, there was. So what did Tiffany do?
Well, so she obviously, once she realized her son was not coming back after the 3 weeks, she realized… I guess she assumed or realized that the son was in now in South Korea. They had fled.
Mm-hmm.
And forgive me if my facts aren't 100%, but this, according to an actual movie that was…
Did you watch it?
No, I watched a scene. So this could be a dramatization of the facts. That's why I kind of gave that little disclaimer. But apparently she logged into his email and that's how Tiffany found out that they went to Korea. And so she… It was like this dramatic scene of her going to the police station. The police are like, well, we don't know what to do. We can't help you. Uh-huh. And she's like… She has this email basically of the evidence of, oh yeah, they're gone. And then the police cop was like, well, be careful what you say because, you know, you're basically like, you know, incriminating yourself by hacking into his email essentially. And she was like, never mind. Anyway, so…
This is very good. Just tell the whole thing. Say the whole movie.
Long story short, so this is a Lifetime movie, I believe, that they made based off of all of this.
Yeah.
But so anyways… she ended up connecting with She ended up connecting with a man named Mark Miller, who is the head of the American Association for Lost Children.
Or I checked out their website. I looked at it. Did you see it?
I did not.
I thought this, American Association for Lost Children. It really is like a small time looking nonprofit with just… Whoever's running it is running it, kind of thing. I mean, it doesn't look like it's a smooth operation.
Probably according like one to of those website. Old school, like 20-year-old websites.
Yes, it looks like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really cool what they do, but definitely it sounds a lot slicker than how it appeared when I checked out their site.
Yeah.
But yeah, they were very involved in this.
Yeah, interesting. So this is actually a charity in Pennsylvania that will… They will actually physically go out and search for missing children.
Right.
So that is very interesting in and of itself.
Kind of reminded me of, what was it called? There was this, this nonprofit that used to go and rescue North Korean refugees.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm talking about? This was really popular, like in 2009 was the first time I heard about it, where you could join this local, it was like this nonprofit, and then you could join them to actually go into North Korea and rescue North Korean refugees and bring them across the border.
Oh, wow.
I've heard of
different organizations. Usually they're like church related or Christian affiliated.
Yeah.
That would do that. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know if they're religiously affiliated as far as the AALC. But regardless…
It just came to my mind.
Yeah, no. Regardless, I mean, they will actually physically help locate the children.
Mm-hmm.
And so in December 2008, Mark Miller, I believe, received a tip. Or was it Tiffany?
I think it was Tiffany.
Okay, so Tiffany received an anonymous tip via MySpace.
MySpace. Who knew that MySpace would ever come up in a helpful way?
MySpace was
was
a thing
it your jam?
Okay. Oh yeah, of course, my top 8. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, so she actually received an anonymous tip. So this is what, maybe about a year, give or take, after, or maybe just months after.
Kobe had been missing for… quite some time now.
Yeah, yeah. And so the tip said that Kobe was spotted in a school which is right outside of Seoul.
Yeah.
And also included with the tip was the fact that he was struggling, getting picked on for his language barrier.
Right,
I mean, he was what, 7 or 8?
Right, when he was kidnapped.
Right,
he was a little bit older.
Yeah, from the States. So obviously he was, you know, speaking English and then he had to be in a Korean school system.
And on top of that, he's mixed Korean. Right. So his mother is Black American, father is Korean.
Right.
So he has, I'm sure for Kobe, this couldn't have been an easy time.
Right, right. Yeah. So at this point, after receiving the tip, and this is kind of cool, and I see why they made a movie, because this is where they created like this rescue mission, right? Where Tiffany and the AALC, they made a plan. They actually secured funds and then they traveled all the way to South Korea to rescue or to bring back Kobe.
Literally to go to get him. Now that they knew where he was, Tiffany has the legal right, the custodial right to have her son who had been kidnapped. So of course, under the Hague Convention as well, South Korea should be on her side. And then I think the thing that further propelled them was that the FBI warrant was out on Psycho, which meant that local authorities and the U.S. embassies in Korea would be more willing to help out this small charity and Tiffany.
Yeah, yeah. So that actually worked to their benefit that he was essentially wanted.
Yes, yes, it did. So the actual rescue operation. So Tiffany met up with the anonymous tipper and they went to the school to find Kobe. And she disguised herself in a wig. She had skin lightening makeup. I think she's just trying not to draw attention to herself in Korea. And when they went to the classroom, she called his name, Kobe. And apparently, I guess she called it like three times or something. Oh, that's too poetic. But she called his name and he recognized her and went to her. And she had to convince the teacher, oh, this, I'm his mother. This is my son. And the teacher was like, okay, yeah, I believe you, right? Mm-hmm. And Kobe obviously was happy to see her. And so the teacher allowed them to go outside. And I think this is what's the key part. Because in the other stories, the children do not go to their parents, their fathers. Like in John's case or Jay's parents' case. I'm getting confused. In John's case or in Jay's case, the children did not say to the police officers, oh, that's my dad. I'm going to go to them.
Yeah. Because
they're so young. But in this case, Kobe did go to his mother. So I think this is kind of where like that, I don't know, that legal snarling that happens in the local police system in Korea. They were able to overcome that. And so when they went outside, they disguised Kobe as a girl. Changed his clothes, put on, I guess, a wig, and they took him directly to the American embassy. And that's where the embassy then quickly processing their documents.
Right. And they're pretty much at the home stretch point where they're at the airport about to go back to the States. And lo and behold, the Korean immigration, they resisted letting Kobe get on the flight and leave because apparently the process had been started for him to get dual citizenship or to make Kobe rather a Korean citizen.
Right. So I think he had revoked the passport at this point, like the American passport.
Yeah. And so so this is started obviously by his father.
Yeah.
And luckily the U.S. officials, they stepped in and they negotiated a $100 fine to get his, I guess, expired passport. I don't know. Effective or whatever, just to be able to leave the country.
Well, it just seems like that was kind of a smart move. Like Korean immigration to them, it would be like, oh, he doesn't have American passport. He doesn't have any passport. He cannot leave the country.
Yeah.
But the U.S. officials who would have known about the FBI warrant and, you know, her right to have custody over her son, it's cool. They stepped in and negotiating the $100 fine is just like, oh, it's just an expired passport. See, it's okay. Cover it. Is cool. I imagine that must have been a very frightening moment.
Right.
At any point, you don't know when Sarko is going to figure this out. He could have gone to the school to pick up Kobe and then been like, what? And obviously he would know right away who had taken him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So everything had to line up for this to really take place. And they had a little resistance, but they were able to overcome it. Now, I mentioned that this was made into a Lifetime movie. And it actually stars Taraji P. Henderson.
Oh, yeah.
I think I said her name right. I mean, I've seen her like we were watching the Karate Kid, the one with Jaden Smith.
Yeah.
And she's, you know, Jaden's mom
in
the
cute
movie.
She's in that one for sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, she's, you know, pretty well known.
Yeah.
So anyway, she plays the mother. And this scene of… So I watched the scene of like the anonymous tipper.
Oh.
Or not the tipper, but the guy who was like orchestrating, like, I guess it was Mark Miller in the movie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so it's just a very dramatic, like,
of course,
she
it's
breaks
dramatized.
Into, of course, she goes into the school and like, you know, the little, I don't even think he was Black and Korean in the movie. you know, but anyways, like he comes, recognizes the mom, and then they like essentially like run out of the school and they try to catch a taxi. Cause I think they actually caught a taxi in real life, but there was like this guy chasing them and they were like, they barely made it into the taxi and the taxi sped off. So I don't know if that happened in real life, but definitely like watch that clip. It's on YouTube.
Yeah.
It's kind of fun.
Either way, high stakes happening here. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
So they did make it back to the US and Kobe is living with his mother now. It seems that in 2009, because if Sawako tried to return to the US, he would have been arrested because of the mm-hmm. FBI warrant. And he was arrested in Guam in 2009. He served time in West Virginia. He was released sometime later. He was not legally allowed to contact Kobe until Kobe was 18.
Right.
So as of that update that I read in that recent article, he did contact Kobe in 2020. And Kobe does say that my relationship with my father now is not very existent. And I think this is the part where I think is easily overlooked in these kind of stories. Because you hear it's an incredible story of a mother's love. It's an incredible story of the how far she will go mm-hmm. to find her child. And it seems he and his mother are close with each other. And that's a beautiful ending in this situation. But what he does say is that he acknowledges that the lack of a relationship with his father has affected how he views his racial background. And he says, the act of reconciling my biracial heritage of both African American and Korean is very complex. This is something I'm always working through. And I suspect I will spend much more of my life working through it.
Right.
And I think it is so easy to overlook something like that because it is true in the case like here, if one parent is not present in your life or it is almost something you might be afraid of because of how traumatic that was for him going to Korea at that age and his interaction with his Korean father.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt that just makes it a little bit more difficult trying to understand your own identity in terms of that.
Yeah. So it's in a sense, it's like you're rescued from one trauma and it opens up the door to other potential, you know, traumas or effects of that trauma, you know, as far as him not having maybe access to Korean culture or like missing, you know, maybe that part of him.
Right. Right. So, which will always be with him. You know,
of course,
matter where you are.
Yeah.
And this is kind of circling back around to the case of John Si-chi that I have thought about it because John Si-chi is white. He's American. His mother is Korean. So their children, of course, are mixed. Now young, living in Korea, growing up with their Korean mother. And at this age, I don't think it's possible for them to know like this news that's going out about their father, seeing what he's doing to get them, his protest, all of those things. They will only know, you know, what their mother is telling them and their surroundings.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about those kids and I think, what if John never is able to retrieve them? What if they grow up thinking of their father in one light, whatever their mom tells them? And then years later, when they are old enough and they do see this media coverage of their own father, I think about like what that might be like if their children do not have a true understanding or access of who their father is.
Right.
And will that benefit their relationship with their mother?
Right.
Or, who knows?
Yeah. I mean, you could only hide this from your children for so long.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's just
very complicated
a sad, complicated case all around. No matter what happens at this point, you know, even if the kids are retrieved and back into the father's custody, you know, there's still, and of course, I'm pretty sure John Si-chi is aware of this. There's another like journey of like reestablishing who he is to them mm-hmm, and them mm-hmm. maybe having to learn English again. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's just a long journey ahead.
Yeah.
And we definitely hope for the best and we want for, I guess, justice at the end of the day to be served.
It's not just justice in this case too. It's like that personal aspect of your own identity. Who am I? Literally mm-hmm. my parents and then their biracial identity and where they are. How your relationship is to the country that you're in, you know? Is Korea a place that I was kidnapped to or is Korea my home?
Right.
There's that additional layer. So those are things that we think about and I guess it's going to play out before our very eyes with this case of John Si-chi. So this, as we said, John Si-chi and Jae-sung's case is currently ongoing. There have been recent updates like March 2023, NBC released another one about it. And it seems that it's pretty much an endless circle at this point. So mm-hmm. if you want to be able to help out, I would just say you can spread the word yourself. You can share this podcast with other people and also head over to our website where you can sign the petition. We'll have a link to his site and you can look a little up more about that. And there are videos in English as well where you can read or hear what's going on in John's case. So that, this is a situation of parental international abduction in Korea. And what can you do about it? Looks like at the moment there isn't too much. So, you know, hope this doesn't happen to anybody else. Is there anything else that you wanted to add to this, Cooks, before we head over to listener mail?
No, I think I'm good on my end.
Okay. All right. Well, that sounds good. So because he said he's good on his end, it's time for listener mail. So I wanted to release a quick correction. We released the Marilyn Monroe episode, which was well received. I think that was a really cool one because it does feel like, oh, what does it have to do with mixed race? It doesn't necessarily have to do with being mixed race, but it does have to do with these cross-cultural connections that exist and sometimes we forget about. And it's also just an interesting moment of like pop culture of both Korea and the US. So I love that. And it's important, I think, for us to always be to learn about all these things because makes you proud of where you're from. And it's just the more information that you have stacked up inside of you, the more that you can claim understanding. That was Marilyn Monroe. I wanted to talk about the Kim sisters. I was like,
yeah. Oh.
You know what? You can take everything I just said about Marilyn Monroe, translate it to the Kim sisters because that's kind of a similar thing. Yes, we released an episode on the Kim sisters, which I hope you enjoyed. And in there, we mentioned Tom Ball. He was the one who had scouted the girls at the very beginning. So here's a quick correction that I read up a little bit later. It wasn't Tom Ball who was the manager who exploited them. I read it was Bob McMackin, and they paid him off like a couple tens of thousands mm-hmm. so that they would no longer be under his management. That was something I had read. So in case okay. I was wrong about the Tom Ball thing, it was Bob McMackin.
Awesome.
Yes. So in the meantime, if you are curious about more things, you want to see photos of what we're talking about, you want to see some links, the link to John Cici's petition, all that, of course, you can always check it out at our website, thehaffyproject.com. I've also finished writing my little series about the Sindaebang House, my own personal story that happened to me. And you can read that on the website under the blog. And as always, if you have things that you want to say, you've got questions or topics you want to hear about, you can always write into us at thehaffyproject@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. We are The Haffy Project.